morning and welcome into the 9 to 10 show for this Friday, the 10th day of April, a forensic Friday, which means Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson is with us. Raymond, good morning.
Good morning, Jack.
How are you?
Well, I'm wet.
Yep. Get up on that microphone. You're also weak. Weak and wet. Speak up.
Leave me alone.
Okay. Yeah. Brought to you by Landscapers Corner, 1305 Old Frankfort Pike. They have Triple Crown Elite Grass Seed available in 5, 25, and 50-pound bags, 225-9433. Our question of the day brought to you by United Structural Systems, your foundation repair and waterproofing experts, ifixfoundations.com, 859-254-7700. And Ray always likes for me to ask him our question of the day. So here we go. It is, were you surprised that a record 7 UK players will enter the NBA draft?
Nope.
I wasn't either. Although I thought it was going to be 5, but I didn't know it was going to be that many. But all right, the question yesterday is, should the Boston bomber be sentenced, should he receive the penalty of death?
Well, it's in Kentucky, he's eligible for the death penalty for two reasons. Mm-hmm. Number one, he used a bomb and somebody was killed. And the other thing is, it's multiple murder, you see. So he qualifies, and as here, juries make that decision. Mm-hmm. And so what do I think? I think he deserves all the punishment he can get. If that includes the death penalty, well.
So be it.
Huh? Sayonara.
All right. Well, that was our question yesterday, and the results were 70% said yes, he does deserve the death penalty, and 30% said no. And, okay, this is a Forensic Friday, as we told you, and Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson with us with a couple of guests that he has brung along with him. Who'd you brung?
Well, Chris Schoonover is a detective with the Homicide Unit in the Lexington Police Department. He's been a detective in that unit for quite a while.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You've been on this program many times in the past. We're glad to have you back.
Thank you.
And Brad Ingram is going to pull that microphone down in front of him a little bit.
There you go, Brad.
And Brad is the new lieutenant. How long have you been the lieutenant there, Brad?
It's going on 4 months
now. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Well, good to have you here.
Thank you.
He's a great addition. And so, do we like him, Chris?
The jury's still out.
Jury's still out. I knew that's what he was going to say. I felt that.
Cut his mic off. Turn his mic off.
Well, this is... If you work with the homicide unit at the Lexington Police Department like we do, it is really a competent bunch of folks. And
How many in the?
Well, let's hear about it.
We got 10. We have 10 detectives assigned to the unit right now.
Okay.
And so, what happens if a homicide were reported right now, and how does your unit operate?
Well, right now would be during normal business hours for us.
Right.
They usually get in about 7:30 in the morning and don't go home till about 5:30 or 6
right.
each night. They work hard. They're very dedicated. So right now, we have an on-call list for the detectives. So whoever's next in the rotation would get that call and
respond. Is that one person, or they travel together in twos?
That's one person. It's on call. They'll go out and assess the situation in the scene and then call in the cavalry for support, and we'll all show up.
Well, yeah, what happened, let me tell you how it works. Brad just didn't get to it. But this is a group that operates as a team.
Okay.
And for a very short period of time, number of hours, maybe, as you like to say, Jack, the first 48.
Right.
Everybody is all hands on deck doing whatever the lead detective asks them to do. And so that's how they have such a great clearance rate on homicides in this town, which also leads us into this cold case business. Over the last 5 years, I'll bet you the clearance rate for the Lexington Division of Police's homicide unit is in the mid-90%.
Had 1 year, it was 100%.
Well, 2 years running, it was 100%. And they'll go back and solve. For example, how many unsolved do we have from 2014?
Six.
Yeah. Well, I know of three of them that they're right on the edge of charging, you see.
I'll say four. I'll go with four on that number.
How many homicides do we have in a year? I know it varies from year to year.
We have 15 or 16 a year.
15 or 16.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And so at any rate, our clearance rate is extremely high for the homicide unit as compared to Detroit, for example. And Detroit solves 10% of the homicides.
But they're probably the worst in the country.
Oh, they are. Yeah. And let me put that in perspective. That means there's a 90% chance in Detroit you can get away with a murder.
Yeah.
And that's heavy duty stuff. So, but they have the kind of thing we have only on steroids, and that is this don't snitch kind of culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the problem that you run into in solving these crimes. I think these fellows will tell you. They may not tell you, but I'll tell you. So, how long, Chris, you're the cold case detective now. Tell me when all that started.
It started when the Lexington Police Department got a federal grant for cold cases, and that's when the initial push started for having these DNA test kits tested. So we started a cold case unit to handle all the influx of results for those cold cases, for the rapes, burglaries, and things like that. I've been there 8 years, and we cover missing persons, burglaries, homicides, and rapes is basically what we're doing right now.
What is your coldest case?
Well, of course, everyone knows about the Betty Gail Brown case.
Is that it?
Yes, sir.
1961.
Yes, sir.
Will that ever be solved?
We would like to say yes. We've had some, Detective Robert Wilson and I have had some information in the past few years that we've looked at, and we've sent off some evidence, but, you know, we always like to say we never give up.
So yeah.
That's exactly.
And what is the newest old case? How old does a case have to be considered a cold case?
Well, good question. That's kind of fluid. The parameters are based across the country, basically, for when the leads and the investigator have no further leads to follow up on, or no calls are coming in. But with our department, sometimes when detectives get promoted to sergeant, they take the promotional test and they'll get promoted to sergeant. So then that case, if there's not a number two detective assigned to that case will come into my office, and it's considered a cold case.
So could it literally be a few months old and still be considered a cold case?
That's rare, but it could be.
Could be, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Chris talked a little bit about these kits, and what he's talking about are rape kits.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a period of time when in a lot of communities around the country, rape kits were languishing in police departments, and they hadn't been sent into various crime laboratories. And that created kind of a big issue, because it has those things typically, if semen is collected in a rape kit, then what happens is that they'll get a DNA result on that. And then all of those rape kits started being examined?
What they'll do is the Kentucky State Police Lab will contact me through a letter, answer an email. They'll ask me to look further into the case to see if there was an arrest made, because the lab tech doesn't know the status of that case. They're totally objective in all the testing. And I'll look further into that case, and if arrest has made, they won't test it any further. Or if, say, the victim doesn't want to go through the court procedures and doesn't want to pursue criminal prosecution, then they'll stop further testing as well.
How long have rape kits been used?
Oh, since I know, since I've been on.
Way before DNA, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Well, now see, and as a matter of fact, in 1992, there was an article written in the New York Times about how the FBI wanted to use DNA evidence in court. The defense attorneys went crazy in opposition because they didn't think it was scientifically proven.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally it got into court. It was admissible in court. And Bob Stevens, who was on the Supreme Court at the time, matter of fact, wrote the opinion that said, of course, it's admissible.
And how many years ago was that? Oh, any idea? 15?
Probably.
Yeah.
So these rape kits were started to be examined, and they were getting DNA results. And then what they compared those results to what?
Two offenders that they started in a database called the Combined Offenders Index System.
Yeah, it's CODIS system.
CODIS.
And what they do is they'd get matches with somebody on another crime that was part of this rape kit, and as a result, that gave them another lead.
We're taking a break. If you're on hold, stay there. We'll take you when we get back. 253-5959. Touch star 59. 25 minutes after 9, 925, News Talk 590 WVLK. We're talking cold cases this morning. And let's go to the phones. Thank you for holding. Kevin, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I've got a personal experience with a cold case. I'm a retired fireman, and probably 18 years ago, maybe, we had a fire on Malibu Drive in the 100 block on a Saturday morning, and there was a deceased female victim in the back room of that place, and I was just calling to see if you had any information or had been solved or what's the story.
Kevin, when you said that, both of our guests both nodded at the same time, so obviously you guys are know what he's talking about.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was the one that found her. That's why I'm really curious.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. So we probably met that morning. I was on call actually. That had been worked. We have two binders, and when I say binders, I mean like thick binders that several hundred witnesses have been interviewed. That is still unsolved. There are some leads. There are some suspects, of course, but it is still unsolved.
Hmm. How many years ago?
I want to say probably 10 or 12 years ago. Am I correct?
Oh, it's longer than that. I've been retired for 13, so it's probably been 15 to 18 years.
Okay. And I know, again, I've learned so much over the years through this show, the where fires are involved, those are probably the most difficult cases to prove anyway, aren't they? Because most of the evidence is burn up.
Right.
Yeah. Was the lady dead as a result of the fire, or was she dead? Were you able to determine if she had died before the fire?
Yes, she was deceased before the fire.
Okay.
Yeah.
Appreciate your call, Kevin. Thanks.
Arthur, thank you.
All right.
The most of the cold cases that you deal with, you said, are homicides, burglaries. Why burglary?
Some detectives have collected evidence in the past years, and they've moved on, like I said. And I'll review that evidence. Blood has been found on windows where they break through the windows, and I'll find out about that evidence, and I'll send that evidence to the Kentucky State Police Lab and see if they'll run it through CODIS, as we spoke about earlier. And if I get a hit, then I'll look into it further.
Now, a hit means what you do is you get the DNA evidence from the burglary. And so then you run it, you compare it against other DNA samples that they have in their database. And if there's a match, then the person from whom the DNA sample was taken is going to likely be the person that committed the burglary.
That's correct.
Yeah,
that's correct.
So that's how science...
Likely to be or is?
Well, it depends on the nature of the DNA analysis, because they can say that it's, one, the chances of it being this person's DNA is one in 17 quadrillion, whatever that is.
Yeah.
Or it can be one in 20,000.
I see.
You see, and if it's one in 20,000, that makes this guy a suspect.
But it ain't no home run. Right?
Well, it's not that this is the only guy in the universe.
Yeah, right.
And so that's it. And juries have to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt it's a person that committed the crime. So tell me the oldest case you're working on now.
Well, of course, everyone knows Melanie Flynn. I'm continuous working on that. So that's 1977. There is one. Currently, we've received information And how I work it is I have to triage these cases. So if we receive information currently on an older case, which is one from 1999 I'm looking at now.
Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
This gentleman was found in his apartment on North Broadway. And he was killed by a gunshot. And we didn't find him for several days later. His apartment was locked with a deadbolt. So we're looking into that.
Wow. So the person who committed the crime had a key to lock the deadbolt back.
Or took the key
from the victim. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Wow.
How many cases do you have?
Open homicide cases, we have 60 to 62. Two, depending on if they get solved this year, like Mr. Larson has said.
60 to 62. Wow, that's a bunch. We're going to take a break, Ray. Let's take a break right now. When we come back, I want you to address the situation where how difficult it is to go back to court when so much time has passed. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590. 9:35, 25 minutes before 10 o'clock, cold cases. We see that on TV, but they really do exist, and they really have people that work on those here in Lexington. Ray?
Tell me how else you get information.
It comes several ways. We'll get family members. It's a great avenue of information who will go out and talk to the community for us because they usually hear it before the police do. We also get, we find it common that when an individual gets arrested, they'll call and offer up information that they have been withholding for several years.
So just to get it, kind of to get a deal.
Yeah, they always ask for something in return.
I wanted to ask you, Ray, you've said many times on this program, the more space between time and space between the crime and the court, going to court, the harder it is to prove. And the reason for that, I guess, is because you lose people to testify, people die, they move, and that kind of thing. So I guess on some of these cold cases, are they going to, if there's no DNA, it's going to be hard to prove those, right?
Well, that's right. But it's also very hard to locate witnesses. I mean, there's a detective from the police department that's been assigned to our office. His name is Johnny Williams. And he is absolutely a magician at finding witnesses.
Really?
Sometimes you can't find them. And when you do find them, sometimes they're not the least bit interested in being involved anymore.
Yeah.
They forget. Some die. And it's very difficult, but we've done some cold cases. We've prosecuted some cold cases.
Successfully. Here's an email from Robert. He's our friend that listens to us up in Madison, Wisconsin. He listens online. How do other jurisdictions get clued in on possible cold case connections? We see it on TV sometime, but it's usually more luck than a logical connection.
Well, what I do is we'll get a teletype from NCIC that if a serial killer has been arrested, they'll send us the information on where he's been. I also will contact other agencies to see if they've had any arrests that match the same method that our victims have been murdered by. And we keep a pretty open communication through emails and teletypes and things like that.
What is NCIC? This is Crime Fighting 101. And people that listen to this get a degree at the end of this.
I think you ought to make Brad answer that question because he's been so chatty this morning.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't want to steal the limelight from my good detective, Chris Skinover. NCIC is a national database that allows law enforcement to share information, allows us a database to enter information, things we're looking for, vehicles, missing persons, and that. So that we can stay connected, so that when you run somebody out on the street, if they're wanted out of Wisconsin, that information will receive a hit back through NCIC, letting us know that.
That's now, great, isn't it?
Oh yeah. But to our friend Robert from Madison, Wisconsin, we're not particularly pleased with Madison, Wisconsin.
Well, or group. Just Wisconsin generally, right?
Yeah,
right.
That's exactly right. So, Chris, talk to me about these jailhouse snitches, because we have, I've talked about this before, and that what I've said is this culture of don't snitch, meaning what?
Meaning if they call, they ask for a lot of demands from the detectives. Number one, they want to be put in protective custody, or they want to be in a witness protection program, or reduction in sentencing. And most of the time they have more information, but there's a code that they go by that if they tell something, which to us is a normal right thing to do, but right. to them it's an advantage that they have because of the life they live. If they get arrested, this is leverage they have. So, and then it becomes difficult for the prosecution when it goes to Mr. Larson's office, because the defense obviously will key in on that.
Well, how do you give protection? do you give protection in those cases?
We don't. The state does not. Kentucky does not have a witness protection
program. Really, I didn't realize that.
Let's go back to the assassination of Trent DeGiro.
Yes,
by Shane Ragland. Our witness in that case was Shane Ragland's former girlfriend, and we had our friend Don Evans was the detective that broke that case, and he did an excellent job with that. And I almost hate to say that, but he did. And so we had to really talk her into cooperating, because she knew what this guy would do, this Ragland character. And so we were afraid for her. And during the pendency of the trial, we had to move her. She was in Delaware, and we had to move her all the way across the country. And then we had to move her again, and she was under a fake name.
How did you do it? I mean, if we don't have a protection program, how did you do it?
Well, you can do that, but it's not a kind of a thing that they do with on like Goodfellas or those kind of things. We just don't have the specific statutory. We just do it. You just move her.
You just
call her some other name. But the problem is she still has the same Social Security number. And Social Security numbers these days are what people are using to identify or find people.
I see.
And so what happened was after she testified in that case, then Evans got real busy, and we did everything we could to try to get her a new identity and move and get her Social Security number changed. You only do that once, and it's very difficult to do, because, you know, your Social Security, Jack, if you have a mortgage on your house, then you got a problem, because your Social Security number is attached to that mortgage,
mm-hmm.
you see,
mm-hmm.
those kind of things. And so she's somewhere in this country. She's married. She has two or three children and is very happily married, I'm told. I don't have a clue who she is or where she is.
You don't. And she has a new Social Security.
Yes.
Number.
Yeah. And that's about what you do. There's no round-the-clock protection for she and her family and that sort of thing. So.
And the end of that story was?
Well, the end of that story was the Shane. When we talked her into testifying, I said, look, if you'll just do this one time, I promise you can walk away from this thing and never have anything to do with it again. And she did. And she was a great witness. And then the case, the conviction was reversed. So then the question is, is my word good or not? Mm-hmm. That's the question.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you'd never have to do it again. And she reminded me of that. And so he pled guilty to an amended charge, because I was not going to put her back in the mix again.
T- Taking a break. 253-5959. Touch star 590 from AT&T. Got 11 minutes before 10 o'clock. News Talk 590 WVLK. We got a couple of policemen with us this morning from the homicide unit. Actually, Detective Chris Schoonover is in charge of the cold case division of our police department. We also have Lieutenant Brad Ingram with us this morning, along with Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson. Ray?
Before we go any further, that Brad is relatively new supervising the homicide unit, and also there is a new commander. They have an assistant chief over Bureau of Investigations, that's Ron Compton, and then there's a commander that kind of manages all of the personal crimes group, and that would be David Lyons. And David Lyons has been on this show before.
Mm-hmm.
He's the little guy. It's about my size.
Okay.
And I've just been notified by somebody at the police department that today is David Lyons' birthday.
Happy birthday, David.
Yeah. So we want to make sure we say that.
Sure.
So cold cases, you're continuing to get information from people on these things. How many cases could you say that you have solved since you've been in 8 years doing this?
We have solved 10 cases.
Mm-hmm. How many convictions? How many convictions out of those 10?
There are convictions.
I won't hold you to
bargains,
it, but just
no, including plea bargains, all 10.
All 10?
Well, there's one that the suspect had killed himself.
Okay.
So I would consider that a conviction.
That'd be a conviction. But so that's good. That's good track record.
Well, Chris knows that when you're dealing with cold cases, you better have your act together because it's an old case.
Right.
And the proof becomes old, and it's there's some real challenges when dealing with 12 people on a jury. You know, you got to have a unanimous verdict.
Is it difficult in the grand jury process too to get them to?
Well, with the grand jury, we just present the facts, the evidence.
So it doesn't matter really how old the case is to the grand jury.
No, it's the evidence is for example, Chris will come in and present the evidence, and then Chris leaves and we leave the room, and then the grand jury deliberates. We don't ever try to, we really don't ever try to influence the grand jury. We want the grand jury to be a barometer of the strength of the case.
Yes.
In addition to all of the rest.
But obviously you think you can get a conviction or you wouldn't take it to the grand jury. Yes or no?
No. If Chris makes an arrest on a case, we present it to the grand jury. We have to present the case to the grand jury. And the grand jury makes a decision whether there is sufficient evidence to return an indictment against the person. Now, they're a good barometer. You know, as Chris would testify, they may ask questions. And it's very important to listen to those questions that grand jurors ask of the witness. Because if they have the questions, you know a pettit jury is going to have those questions.
Right.
And so then we make sure that we work on those areas that they ask questions about.
Now, you have a cold case now that you think you're getting close to?
I wouldn't say close, but I'm working actively every day on that case.
Yes. Okay.
Let me tell you what else he does. As Ray alluded to, these guys working as a team. Chris is really motivated to help the newer detectives in the unit solve their cases because he doesn't want them, okay? So he's very good at that. He's very good at being there for those other detectives to ask questions and to get his advice. So I appreciate his efforts, and I'm sure the guys do too.
That's good.
Well, okay, Chris, now it's your turn to say what a great supervisor. Brad, come on, this is...
The jury's just in. He's been doing very well.
Yeah.
Right,
oh,
exactly.
Oh, man.
That's funny.
So, I want to talk about these rape kits for just a minute because there's kind of not a controversy, but there's a lot of issues out there about rape kits that languish in police departments or languish in places like that. There was a big push to get them all done. I know that Chief Barnard is fired up about getting these things in. Now, what you were telling me before we came in here a little bit about this, that the crime lab is interested in what cases? Rape kits.
The rape cases. The kits that we send off, they actually, we are in communication as well. They'll send me an email. Once that kit gets to them, they'll request another kit. Now, they just got a new machine that they'll be able to test more samples at one time than they have been before. So that helps their backup. But they work very hard at getting these samples done. And the turnaround time is becoming shorter and shorter. So we can send in more kits at that time.
You know, Jack, it's very important that our legislature fund the crime lab, because they're having to compete with all kind of people for these biologists and these scientists and that sort of thing. And they leave over there. And the legislature has to fund the scientific nature of the investigations, because that's where we are these days.
Yes. And is there, back to those rape kits, is there a shelf life to semen? If it's stored properly, will it last forever? Or is the, you don't know?
No, there is a shelf life to everything, but I don't know what that term would be.
Guys, thank you very much. Thank you, Ray. We'll see you next week. Okay. Stand by. We have an update from the Information Center. Live with Lee is next. Have a great weekend, and I'll be back Monday morning at 6, 5 Central.